Committee on Human Services together.
As a subcommittee.
And subcommittee. So we're going to bring you up to date on the ever-changing agenda. You want to go through what we have?
Thank you, Senator. There won't be a hearing on Senate Bill 750 today.
Actually, that bill has been withdrawn, so is anybody here to testify on 750? Okay, nobody here.
Thank you. We will be bringing a couple presenters in, or people testifying on Senate Bill 417. When we get down to Senate Bill 973, however, we're only going to open the hearing long enough to bring on, by conference call, one person testifying. So if anybody is here to testify that's in the room on 973, Senate Bill 417 is similar, and we prefer you come up and testify at the same time we do 417. So, again, we'll just open the public hearing on 973 long enough to bring in a person by conference call.
Okay.
And Senator Brown.
Okay. So I see our carrot cake people have returned. Okay, we're going to open a public...
Want to be here by 973?
Oh, okay. Open a hearing on 973. Public hearing on 973, and Senator Kate Brown is here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, State Senator Kate Brown, I represent Senate District 21. I don't know if you want to call in Mr. Ron Johnson at this point in time. Feel free to do so.
We could.
Okay.
Let's do it.
We're going to stand at ease for just a moment.
Okay. All right.
Call in.
Okay.
Yeah. Senate Bill 973. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21, East Portland, and the City of Milwaukee. This bill is brought to you at the request of Joanne and Ron Johnson. I believe Mr. Ron Johnson is on the telephone. The bill arises over the fact that the Johnson's daughter was murdered over 3 years ago, and there were two grandchildren involved. One of the grandchildren was adopted by the father's family, and in that adoption process, the Johnsons did not get notice of the adoption and were not included in the adoption process. The bill is drafted very broadly. I think we can have a conversation about amendments to narrow the context of the bill. I know that the first section of the bill is already included in another bill, which I drafted at a constituent's request, Senate Bill 417. But I really urge you to listen to the Johnsons' story. I think the other issue that arose is that the sibling of the two boys, the siblings, now really, frankly, have limited contact. And it seems appropriate in some of these adoption cases when there are siblings that the siblings should have some legal rights as well. So I will leave it at that and ask Mr. Johnson to share with us his story.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson,
yes, sir.
How much time will you need to tell your story?
Oh, a couple of minutes.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes is adequate.
Okay.
So, good. Why don't you go ahead? Introduce yourself first, please.
My name is Ron Johnson. My wife is Joanne Johnson. We're from Medford, Oregon. My daughter, Carrie, was killed in May of 2002. Immediately after her murder, my youngest grandson went with his father, naturally, and stayed with his brother. My oldest grandson went with his natural father, Shane Deskin. We didn't have much contact with Drake until his father was arrested, and after that it's been very sporadic, seeing the boy, getting the two boys together. The main thing is the two brothers. They were Mutt and Jeff their entire life since the younger one was born, and they were, besides losing their mother, they lost each other at the same time, and we continue to have trouble seeing the youngest grandson, so we went to an attorney to find out about what we could do about the fact, and she told us to file for guardianship. We did, and we went to mediation with the other side of the family, and nothing happened at the mediation. We could not come to a conclusion. And we went back to our attorney, and through checking things out, she found that there had been adoption filed on the grandson, and we had no idea about it. We, at that time, went on to try to get full guardianship, and it was about a 18-month, two-year struggle, and we lost on all counts. Our grandson was adopted by his father's brother and his wife. We lost all legal rights to anything to see the boy, and we see him very seldom. We haven't seen him in 3 months now. And it's just not my wife and I seeing our grandson. It's the two brothers that have been separated. My oldest grandson also lost his father in 2003 to a drunk driver. So now he's lost everything in his life, including his little brother. And our point would be that at least both sides of the family should be informed when a child's being adopted. And I strongly believe that a sibling, a brother or a sister, should have some rights legally protected, that they can at least have a right to see their brother or sister on at least once a month, or naturally we'd love to see him more than that. But the boy has no rights whatsoever. He is at the mercy of other people if he ever gets to see his brother again. And that's basically our story. It's just, other states, our attorney told us, have siblings have rights, and the adoptions have to become before everyone involved. And I guess in the state of Oregon, you can just file for adoption and have it go through, and nobody is ever informed or aware of the situation. That's basically our story.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions of the committee? Okay. Senator Brown, would you like to...
I just want to add, Mr. Chair, committee members, that I'm willing to do a work group on both 973 and 417, if that's appropriate. Like I said, I think we're going to need some amendments to narrow the framework of 973, but I'm very willing, if the chair wishes, to corral a work group on this issue. I just want to say thank you to Mr. Johnson. I just really appreciate he and his family's willingness to be able to share their story so that other Oregon families don't have to go through the same thing.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Having been involved in the adoption issue in the state back a few years ago, when I first saw this bill, I think I was misreading it. Senator, most of what you're after is on the front end here, isn't it? I guess I looked at this and wondered if it was going to put a cloud over folks wanting to get in to the process of adopting a child, which clearly we don't want to do, by saying that there's a reach back and different things like that. It seems to me that this could be handled by making sure appropriate notification on the front end of any procedure is done. And if that's the direction you want to go, I'd be more than happy to work with you on that. I think that would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that's exactly right. Two pieces, Senate Bill 417 addresses this as well, but basically both bills allow birth relatives and other persons who have a legal relationship with the child to enter into a contractual relationship with the adopting parents, and I think that's appropriate. The other piece, I think what was instructive for the Johnson family is that they weren't even entitled to notice, and that the brother of their grandson wasn't even entitled to notice. And I think it was appropriate under the circumstances that their mother was deceased, that the family should have at least had notice, and the court should have taken an opportunity to hear from them of the circumstances of the case. And so I think that's really critical, is the upfront notice. No, we don't want to cloud legally these adoptions, and I think there's actually some language in the bill that might do that. We don't want to do that.
Mr. Chair, this the case you're describing is somewhat extraordinary, and it's completely different from the normal process of termination that we go through. And clearly we need to be sensitive to this sort of issue, but termination can be a bit messy in and of itself. So I think as long as we have an objective in mind to make sure we aren't stepping on good process already in place, that we might be able to come to resolution here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. We really appreciate your willingness to hear this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll close the public hearing Senate Bill 973 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 303. Rocky, would you come up, please? Would you explain the bill?
Thank you, Senator. And what I will do is briefly just explain this is, in essence, a name change bill for the Insurance Pool Covering Board plus a few other items. And we'll defer to Mr. King to basically kind of walk through briefly what the bill does, since it is lengthy. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and I would like to take you through Senate Bill 303 and a little bit of historical context and the reason that we've put forth this bill. The bill really is designed to do three things. First of all, to abolish the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which we refer to as IPGB, and create a new Office of Private Health Partnerships. Secondly, it abolishes the current 7-member policymaking board that oversees IPGB, but enables the administrator of the new Office of Private Health Partnerships to create an advisory committee or committees to provide similar policy and program consultation and advice. And finally, the bill clarifies for the new Office of Private Health Partnerships authority to establish procedures for publication and release of aggregate data of applicants or persons enrolled in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, as well as other programs that we administer. Let me just give you some historical context of the agencies. IPGB was first established in 1987 to basically encourage small businesses, by designing small business health insurance plans, to enroll their employees and dependents in coverage when before they had not offered coverage. There was no budget and no staff, just a 7-member board that was told to go do these good things. With limited support from a variety of state agencies, primarily then the insurance division, they designed those plans and they came out with them in 1989. In 1989, the legislature first established the first funding for the IPGB, and it was about $228,000, very small amount of money, in two positions in order to carry out the directives of the agency. In that same year, and I want to make sure that everybody understands that the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, or OMIP, the high-risk pool, is a separate entity, but we are very closely linked through the administration of the programs, and I'll explain that. But 1987, OMIP was established. No dollars, no position authority. In 1989, there was finally some dollars given to OMIP, but no positions. So the two boards got together in 1989 and said, look, you've got a whole bunch of money over here at OMIP. We've got a couple positions over here on the IPGB side, but very little money. How about if we come together through an interagency agreement and really have the same staff and share the administrative costs and administer these programs together? And both both boards agreed to that. In 1990, January 1, they hired the first two staff, of which one of those is still sitting before you for the last 15 years. So things went along pretty good. In 1993, Governor Roberts, if you recall, said we need to consolidate a large number of the smaller agencies into larger agencies. There were 180 separate small state agencies, and actually Gary Weeks can probably give you a better figure than I can on that. He was a part of that process. The IPGB was included in a bill to go to Department of Human Services. At that point, it was called, I think, the Department of Human Resources. And the OMNIP program was put in a bill to go to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which was a new, it used to be Division of Insurance and Finance, I believe, DIF, and it was being created as Department of Consumer and Business Services. The OMNIP bill passed, and OMNIP ceased being a separate state agency and went under DCBS. The IPGB bill did not pass and remained as a separate state agency. But the relationship in terms of sharing administration and administrative staff and both costs and services continued even after DCBS assumed the responsibility for OMIP. Okay. In 1995, the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research came before the legislature and made a proposal to move IPGB under DCBS. Again, it was still a separate state agency. After receiving a lot of testimony from insurance carriers, the business community, and agents, that bill was modified to exclude IPGB. There was a real, I think, concern that the role of IPGB has been to bridge the public and private sector, and putting it either in the DCBS side, which is more regulatory oriented, or the DHS side, which is more social service, it would lose the advantage it has, which is really bridging those two. So we had continued basically to operate IPGB as a separate state agency governed by a board. It at that point had a very limited budget. It had grown based on some expansion in 1993 to about $500,000 and three staff. But things changed in 1997 with the establishment of what's called the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP. Most of you are, I think, are familiar with that. That's a program that's designed to help subsidize low-income individuals under 185% of poverty purchase private health insurance in either the individual or group markets. That did a couple things to us. First of all, it expanded us greatly in terms of our budget authority, and it expanded in terms of a position. We've gone from three positions back in 1995, three or four positions, to almost 52 positions within IPGB now. And the governor's budget request with the FEOP expansion that was really set forth by the 2001 and the 2003 legislature is going to entail about an $80 million budget if the governor's budget is approved as submitted. So the growth of IPGB has really expanded over the last six, 7 years, and to have a small policy board still make all the decisions about the program really, I think, is something that no other state agency really has in the sense of its size and rapid growth.
Now, let me just ask a question about what would there will be a fiscal impact associated with this bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the fiscal impact is a wash because we will continue the interagency agreement and share the administrative costs. The only impact that we see is the establishment of an administrator's position within the IPGB, because there is no director of IPGB. It's really on the OMIP side. So they'll establish the position. However, because of the administrative agreement, the money is already there on the IPGB side to pay for that position. 91% of that position is already paid for
now,
by IPGB.
The reason I'm asking that question is because we intend to move this bill out today.
That's correct.
So you don't have to tell us too much about it.
Yeah. So there really is no fiscal impact.
Well, no, I think we are satisfied with the justification of the bill. The question is, does it goes away? Will it go to Ways and Means, or will we just send it to the floor and pass it out? Now, if you're assuring us that the fiscal is not a real fiscal and can be taken care of, we will pass it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I assure you that the fiscal impact basically is a wash, and whatever costs are associated with that change, for example, changing stationery,
yes,
that can all be planned where you run one out before you print the other, so there's very minimal cost that would be involved, and it would be assumed by agency staff in making those changes.
Okay. Now, let me... Oh, okay, questions?
Yeah, I will. Rakia, initial opposition to the bill simply because it's an acronym I'm comfortable with and I don't like to see it changed. But beyond that, does this bill also, I can see one reason for it maybe going to Ways and Means, and that's for spending limitation, spending authority. Is that addressed in the bill? We're creating something new or transferring money. Does this give you the authority to spend the money?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, it does. If you read the bill, it kind of just moves everything over from the IPGB to the office. So all contracts, all obligations, all limitations, the budget, everything is just assumed moving over straight.
Other question?
I have one.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right to page 11. If you would just...
of the bill?
Of the bill, yes, I'm sorry. Page 11 of the bill, lines 8 through 10. It says the office may establish by rule the procedures for publication and release of aggregate data that relates to applicants for enrollment and persons enrolled in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. That's new language. I know in common usage what aggregate data means, 100 people, average income, 33,000. I don't know that there, I guess my comfort level though is I don't know that there's a legislative term for that, and what, since it's by rule as opposed by statute, I wouldn't want this otherwise undisclosed information about individuals. One could interpret aggregate data being a whole book of everybody singly listed and collectively. And so I have just a little heartburn about that. If you could discuss that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, this language came from Legislative Council. Let me give you a little background on that. We were asked for some information about the employers that were enrolled, had people from FEOP enrolled. And there are some federal HIPAA requirements that basically you can't give out information to the extent that you could identify of a particular employer who was enrolled in FEOP. And so we went to the Attorney General's office and said, we have this request, and our sense is that, we could be in violation of HIPAA or put someone at risk of this. And they said yes and affirmed our decision not to provide that. But in the review of that, they also said, it really has never been said that you couldn't say there are 100 employers that are involved. Our statutes didn't even allow us really, in one view, to provide large scale, our average income, the number of employers, our average age. So that was the term that the Legislative Council, I should say, came up with. So to ensure that we were not violating anyone's individual rights if we gave averages and average premiums, average incomes.
Okay, well, I just think that's important to have on the record that this is the intent of that language.
That's correct.
I'm satisfied with that.
Oh, most definitely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Where does the, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Where does the, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, where does the, is this the data that you get? How do you get that data?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Moe Sanderson, that primarily comes from applications. If you ask me, for example, what's the average, what's the number of children, we, in our database, are able to add up the number of children we serve. It's 50% in the group market, 30% in the individual. So it's all from the application and what we call the enrollment and billing screens where we're paying the subsidies.
And follow?
Yes.
Will you need software or, new...
Ms. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, we have all that information. All the systems are in place to collect that. This just makes sure that it's not a violation of law. If you ask me a question about our program and I give you aggregate information or general information, that it's not a violation of statute. When we put the program together in 1997, we were so concerned about the privacy of those individuals enrolling in our program that we put a very, very tight definition there of what we could share and couldn't didn't share. And this is just really in response to maybe we got too tight from being able to share larger scale program information.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, just kind of a response, because I was on the committee in 97 that created this, and it's a wonderful program. I really think it's a wonderful program, and the last two legislative sessions, as we've tried to do a forward look, it would have been handy to be able to have some aggregate data on where we are so we can tell where we need to go. So I think this is not, I mean, this is what we've wanted you to be able to do, so I think this is a good add.
Other questions? Okay, the latest decision on what to do with this bill is to check with the President's office, see if we can rescind the referral to Ways and Means before we do that, and to schedule this on Tuesday for a public hearing and possible work session. So we would intend then to come back on Tuesday, and if you are here, we can open up the public hearing, and if there are more questions to be answered, we can do that, and then we would do the work session and move it, assuming that everybody is supportive, which I think they are, and move it, and then we'll either send it, hopefully we can just send it straight to the floor and get it moving instead of having to go to Ways and Means and languish until the last minute and so on. So that's what we'd like to do. And so with that...
Oh, wait, Mr.
Yes.
I just want to make one statement.
Okay.
I sort of agree with Senator Cruz. I hate it when the agency changed name. It took me at least 5 years to now really remember to how what the IPGB and let alone what it means, and now we're going to office
now wait just a minute. Now we don't use acronyms anyway. Is that not true?
Yes, sir.
So we don't have to worry about that unless you can come up with the words that match the present acronym, and then we don't have to worry about them. Can you come up with a different?
Mr. Chair.
Just be thankful, Senator, they aren't changing FEOP as well. So this is one change. Okay. That's not bad.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Respond if you can.
Senator Moshe Anderson, all of us we branded the name Insurance Bill Governing Board. The reality is, though, we don't govern. I mean,
correct.
The name doesn't mean much either, but it is a branded name.
I learned
name.
It.
It is a branded name.
Okay.
In the new name, whether it takes on or not, I don't care. What we hope, though, is that our relationships with stakeholders, the relationships with the insurance carriers, the agents, the consumers, it's the integrity and the customer service you do. That's what we want to brand, not just the name. And we wish we could have kept the same name, but the reality is you can't abolish an agency and call the agency the same name. And that's why we chose that one. I've done that.
Okay. Okay. The latest decision is we're going to close the public hearing and we're going to open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move we rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means subject to approval of the President of the Senate.
Okay.
Senator Metzger says he's done this before.
Yes.
So,
Senator Metzger, would you?
If I would modify that a little bit, I would move that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, subject to the approval of the President, and send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Second the motion.
In one motion?
One motion.
Okay.
And we have a second.
We're doing the public's business in public right now.
Representative, please repeat that. There's already a motion on the floor.
My motion was to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means subject to approval of the President of the Senate and move Senate Bill 303 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I misspoke the first time.
Discussion? Okay. Any disagreement? Okay, why don't we go ahead and call the roll then?
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Montana?
Aye.
And Chair Morissette?
Aye.
Oh, Senator Starr?
It's amazing we're all here at once, I know.
Okay, now we have responsibility shared on this.
I'll take responsibility.
Okay.
Who's carrying
the bill? Senator Cruz is going to carry. Senator Metzger is going to carry the bill.
I am. Oh my God. Okay.
And we close the work session, and the bill is headed to the floor. Thank you very much. And we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 374. Okay, Courtney Gusser, would you please come forward? And do you have other people to join you? Yes, if all of you would come up, please.
Which one?
The colon.
374?
Yeah. Okay, this bill is scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session. We are not going to have a work session, but we will have the public hearing today. A public hearing. Yes, would you describe the bill, please?
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 374 basically requires a health insurance policy that covers hospital, medical, and surgical expenses to provide colorectal cancer screening and laboratory tests. It establishes the types of screenings required depending on the age of the insured and defines high risk. Establish that this coverage is not repealed on the 6th anniversary of the effective date. There is a repealer statute in law, and this stipulates this treaty bill is not subject to that. Doesn't establish the type of insurers that are required to provide coverage and declares emergency effective upon passage. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Courtney, would you like to lead off?
Thank you, Chairman Morissette, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Courtney Dresser, and I am the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 374. The committee administrator explained, this bill would ensure necessary insurance coverage to men and women over the age of 50 and men and women who are at high risk for colon cancer to receive coverage for several colon cancer screening exams, including a colonoscopy every 10 years. There are two really important reasons why the American Cancer Society is supportive of this bill. One, colon cancer is diagnosed when it's diagnosed at an early stage before it spreads to other organs. The 5-year survival rate is 90%. However, when colon cancer has spread, the 5-year survival rate is only 10%. And the kicker to that stat is only 39% of colorectal cancer cases are diagnosed at an early stage. We also know that with a colonoscopy, we can actually prevent colon cancer by removing the precancer polyps that are inside the colon. I believe that Dr. Kwan and Tina will discuss in their testimony the need for people to get screened. But I want to touch on what I think might be the biggest issue for this committee on this bill, and that'd be the cost. It's important to know that this bill is not looking at diagnostic exams. We're looking at preventative purposes. We're looking at the ability for someone who turns 50 to be able to walk into their doctor and get a colonoscopy and have coverage for that. Right now, we know that there are some plans that do cover this, that cover the whole gamut of colorectal cancer screenings. However, due to private information and business information, it's difficult to know what plans cover what. However, there's an exception to every rule. The Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, which has about 120 different insurance plans that are available to federal employees, does provide their information to the public. We commissioned, the American Cancer Society commissioned a report by the Lewin Group. The Lewin Group is a D.C.-based health policy research company. They looked at these 120 plans of the Federal Employee Program. They found out a couple different things for us. One, that almost all of these plans are covering the yearly FOBT, which is the fecal alcohol blood test, and the flexible sigmoidoscopy, an exam that shows just the bottom third of the colon. Currently, though, only 29% of the plans cover the full range of exams, including a colonoscopy.
many studies have been done that prove the cost effectiveness of a colonoscopy, but they're done in a way that figures out the cost per life year saved. And that can be difficult to understand, and that's not really understandable for insurers and insurees. The Loon Group did our study by doing a per member, per month cost. So basically, we're able to know how much it would cost someone who is in a health insurance plan each month to have these exams. The Loon Group produced a model that looked at three different screening strategies: annual FOBT, annual FOBT with a flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, and a colonoscopy every 10 years. The model also included real-life scenarios such as follow-up care, complications, treatment, and other issues that might arise. They assumed many different things, and they also took into stake a similar model for creating mammogram screenings. Basically, we wanted to compare what these things looked at. The results determined that having coverage for a full range of colon cancer screening exams can happen with little to no additional cost. We found that colorectal screening costs less than the annual mammogram screenings, which is a widely covered screening exam used to find breast cancer at the earliest stage, something that we in Oregon do cover. The results also challenge the assumption that the colonoscopy is the most expensive screening exam. Actually, when you do the FOBT each year and a flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, that actually is the most per member per month cost. However, that's being covered by most of these plans in the federal employee package. We basically have figured out that by adding a colonoscopy, we're talking about pennies per month per member, not dollars. Basically, there are no economical reasons not to include colonoscopy coverage in insurance plans. That may seem a little confusing because we are told that colonoscopies are an expensive test. However, you have to remember that this only happens every 10 years. Also, it's a much more accurate test. And more importantly, that this exam can actually remove the precancerous polyps before they become cancers, saving dollars and, more importantly, saving lives. Our data shows that the full range of colorectal cancer screening tests can be covered with minimal impact on premiums. The science on the colonoscopy is very complete. It works, it saves lives, and if all Americans over 50 practiced regular colorectal cancer screenings, our nation could see a huge reduction in colorectal cancer deaths, up to 80%. This is life-saving legislation. I thank you for this time, and I would like to have Dr. Kwan, if the committee doesn't mind, speak on this bill.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Kwong, and I'm a surgeon who takes care of patients with colorectal cancer, and I also do screening. I work at OHSU and at the Portland VA. I'm also one of the cancer committee chairs at the Portland VA. As Courtney said, colorectal cancer is a significant issue in the United States and in Oregon. It's the second most cancer killer of both sexes, with over 60,000 deaths a year in the United States. In 2001 in Oregon, there were over 700 deaths from this colorectal cancer disease. Those who drafted the bill did a very nice job in delineating the people who would benefit in terms of screening for colorectal cancers, and they also did a nice job describing those who are at high risk. But remember as well that there are the families with high risk, but the majority of patients who have colorectal cancer are sporadic. So 75% of the patients have none of these types of risks. So it covers really every Oregonian. In addition, there's a 5-6% lifetime risk of developing this cancer in the United States. Another significant reason this issue should be addressed is that only about half of the average risk patients or population in the U.S. Are screened for colorectal cancer, and the statistics hold true for the state of Oregon as well, with ranges about 46% or so of Oregonians that are screened for colorectal cancer. And this is a largely preventable disease. Providing colorectal screening is the right thing to do. It costs too much not to screen, actually, with the cost of taking care of someone who does have cancer being way higher than actually screening. And that's not to mention the loss of more productivity, the morbidity and mortality, and emotional and financial impacts on families in the community. And in fact, the data on added years of life is clearer for screening of colorectal cancer than even for mammogram and the treatment of hypertension, which are also, you know, well-proven modalities of effective treatment in healthcare. And as Courtney mentioned, there's evidence that treating this condition early before people get symptoms is much more effective. There's abundant evidence in the literature from the NIH and from New England Journal of Medicine, and some of these large studies even written by Oregonians as well. And they describe the safety, the efficacy, convenience, and really the not large expense for screening. And there's really little potential for harm. I won't go over all of these studies, but there's some of them listed in the testimonial. And so at this time, there are no other proven modalities for prevention of colorectal cancer, so screening is the way to go. All of these studies have data points, and each of those data points are our people. They're my patients who are fathers, my 36-year-old who's a father and a husband, my 78-year-old patient who's a botanist and can name all the plants when we walk around the block still, and those other of the many, many patients. As rewarding as it is to take care of these patients and being part of their care, I would be happy to give up the surgery if it meant that we have succeeded in preventing this disease. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question? Okay. Thank you. Tina?
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tina Halbig, and I don't have a lot of statistics like they do, but I am a cancer survivor. I'm also a volunteer with American Cancer Society. I am chair of Milwaukee Clackamas Relay for Life. I've been involved with that since my first year celebrating survivorship. I'm involved because I want to do whatever I can do to help someone else not go through what I went through. In December of 2000, I was rushed to the emergency room in great pain of my stomach, and the pain was so great that I was unable to stand, let alone walk. It took the hospital a couple days after running repetitive tests to try to figure out what was wrong with me, and it turns out that my colon had ruptured, and they rushed me in for emergency surgery, removed a large portion of my colon, and attached a colostomy bag on my side. A couple of weeks later, I went in back into the doctor's after being released from the hospital a couple of weeks. It was probably about 5 weeks, actually. And the doctor told me that I have cancer. You see, several years earlier, I had been being treated through another insurance company, through another medical facility, and repetitively going in for abdomen pain. They kept sending me home saying, oh, you just have spastic colon, you're just going to have to deal with it. There's nothing we could do for you. I returned to the medical facility several times and saw different doctors trying to get a second opinion from them. And the best case scenario that I got was antidepressants and muscle relaxers, which didn't do me any good. I continued to have these pains that were, the pain was so horrific that it would render me unconscious. I could be out of function, and it would happen that quick, that the pain was so great I would break out into a massive sweat and literally lose consciousness. this medical facility had records that my grandfather had had two bouts of colon cancer and eventually died from the colon cancer. In April of 2000, I had changed jobs, new insurance company, new medical facility. And unfortunately, I didn't go in and complain to them. I guess I learned to do what the first company told me to do and just live with it. And that's what I did. I lived with it. I lived with the pain. I lived with just dealing with it. And while I was in the hospital having the surgery done, the doctor, the surgeon that I was dealing with, talked to me a little bit about my history and what was going on in the past. And I had told him that I had been seeing this one facility and they diagnosed me with a spastic colon. And he looked at me and he said, "You don't have a spastic colon. You have diverticulitis." And had the diverticulitis been diagnosed earlier, I would have probably not have gone through all of what I went through, because it would have been a lot easier to have treated. I could have gone in on a non-emergency surgery, had the section removed, been not had the bag put on my side, and lived normal and no problems. But I'm still fortunate. Cancer was still found early enough. I'm still here today as a survivor. And I just wanted to express to you that I am greatly in favor of this bill being passed to make colonoscopies covered by all insurance companies, and especially for the high risk, you know, whether they have... I was only 40 years old. I wasn't 50, as they're talking here. But I did have the family history that they didn't look at, and the insurance company didn't cover a colonoscopy for me. I went in repetitively to get tests done. They never once suggested this. And unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough on the computer to do research like I am now. But anyway, I am greatly in favor of this bill. I'm filling these purple little hope bracelets in hope for a cure, but today I say I'm in hope of this bill passing. And, Sir Chair and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to share with you my history, my story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tina. Questions? Okay. Thank you. President Courtney, would you come forward, please?
Chair Morissette, members of the Senate Human Resources Committee, Senator Cruz, Senator Charles Starr, Senator Lauren Montana, it's strange, I'm looking at you, it's like I'm looking at my committee, but another committee, but it's close. And I'm here to testify on this piece of legislation, Senate Bill 374. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 11, and I live here in Salem, the district of Salem, and parts of Salem.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he did.
You did identify yourself.
But I'll do it again because you didn't hear it. I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 11.
There you go.
Parts of Salem, all of you, Jervis and Woodburn, 2925 Island View Drive North, here in Salem, 97303.
Well, you have a tendency to mumble sometimes, so I just want to do it.
And you've got a written statement from me, and I don't know. I was upstairs... and I'm sure the statistics are all there for you in terms of the number of cases per year that are diagnosed, as well as the number of people who lose their lives, and what this bill is all about. I don't like to, and those, you know, I'm not going to read.
I think you ought to articulate, though, what you have in this piece.
Well, I will quickly run through it, because I'd rather talk directly to you about this issue. 100,000 cases of colon cancer, they soon will be a diagnosed this year, but that's not an Oregon figure, that's a nationwide figure. They believe somewhere in the neighborhood of 56,000 are dying a year from this thing. And it's the second greatest killer when it comes to cancer. There's different levels of cancer, but this one is this is number two, and this can get you if you don't get it in time. And, but also, this is one of those types of cancer, that
you'll never hear it's going to be higher than 90% chance that you're going to get a shot at curing, but there's a 90% chance, and I'll get to that later, but so you at least have that shot. Several other cancers, you know, if you hear it, it's just a matter of how long you have. Colon cancer, you got a shot, and your best chances are 90%. You're never going to be told you have 100% as soon as it's diagnosed, but you'll be told 90 depending upon how much it's penetrated the muscle wall of the colon. And but the tragedy is, this is a killer, and this is what they're saying. 39%, though, are diagnosed at a time that they can say 90%. So you're only, that 90% is a wonderful statement to come from an oncologist, but only 39% of the people, when they find out they got it, are hearing that. And the trouble is, they come in too late. The tumor has moved into the wall, into the muscle, and it's gone in so far that they come in with a different category when they put it up on the screen, and they tell you, then you got troubles, because then they're telling you, well, this is, and I won't get into all the specifics on it, but this is what goes on. So if you're lucky, you're one of the 39% that are saying, well, this is the level, and I'm not going to use medical terms, but there's only 39% hear that. The rest, the vast majority, 70, almost 60% are hearing, well, your chances are the following, and it starts to go down from there. Now, this bill is an insurance mandate. This is an insurance mandate. No doubt, this is a mandate. I'm just being upfront with you, and therefore I understand its life expectancy, not only in this committee, but the Senate floor, if it's lucky, in this legislature. And that's okay. I accept that. I was here last session, and if I'm here next session, I'll do it again. So this is a mandate. Clearly, this is a mandate. And I'm not going to play games, not going to fudge on this. This is an attempt to say that the test, the screening test, so that you can be not even one of those 39%, you can get in the polyp, precancer polyp stage. And I'm going to get into that without the notes. That'll happen. That's what this is about. Now, there are several tests involved, and they go on, I identify them here, and the cost. The fecal occult one, I'm not familiar with that one. And I personally think it's, I'll just be upfront with you, I'm not a doctor, but that is one that in terms of its reliability, if you get peace of mind after you have that, go ahead and have peace of mind, but you're kidding yourself. The next one is the barium enema, which is not here. It's an uncomfortable test, extremely uncomfortable. It's not painful, but it's very uncomfortable, and it hides a lot of things. You can see certain things in the screen, but it is not that reliable either. But again, peace of mind, people go, yuck, when I talk about the next two tests, but the fact is, it's a test. Is it better than the fecal one? I don't know. In terms of its reliability, whatever. And the cost of those two are there. Now you get to the sigmoid, and you get to the other one, which I can never pronounce, colonoscopy. Now, these, one is the silver standard, as I call it, and the other one is the gold standard. The sigmoid is simply how far is that they do the search is much less than the full colon. It's only the very lower part of the colon. I think it's about 18 inches. It could be longer. It's very good for purposes of that part of the colon, but the tragedy is the colon is, what, sometimes 6 feet long. And so unless you go look at the entire colon, you don't have that gold standard. And trouble can happen throughout the colon. I mean, you can get hit anywhere in the colon. These are the gold standard, because literally, if you're awake, now, that depends upon the sedation. If you're awake, you will literally see your colon. They will point it out to you. They will talk to you about your colon. But if you're squeamish, you may not remember anything. And that's neither here nor there. That's up to you. Now, what does this all mean? Well, someone just mentioned colitis. A certain relevant of mine, very close to me, some of you all know her, was having trouble. And I talked her into going in because there was no history or whatever, but there was some colitis. And I knew when the doctor came out to me, one thing about Oregon, they have probably some of the world's most renowned colorectal surgeons in the world, and they're up in Portland. And one of them, when he came to me in the waiting room, I knew as soon as he was coming at me, something had been found. But he had found a polyp. But he said precancerous. Now, how do you, but you see, you do other tests, and the beauty of these tests is, when they go in, they will clip out the polyp. They clip it out. And that's how they decide whether or not it's cancerous or not. So, if they clipped out a precancerous polyp, you don't have a polyp that could become cancerous because it comes out. That is the beauty of these tests. And sure enough, it was precancerous, which means at least 2 years later, you're coming back in for the same test to see if you're clean. Now, let's say every tumor at one time was a polyp.
and it was precancerous. Let's say the test was taken, and they come to you and they say, well, there's a tumor, or there's something. We don't know. You better hope it's benign, because if it's not benign and it's cancerous, then they got to do a sound wave test. I don't have the, I'm sure the great nurse can describe this. The sound wave test is the best they have at this time, it's my understanding, in terms of trying to get out the depth of the tumor. Then you get into radiation. They've got to shrink that tumor. They got to go in there and cut that thing out. And that often involves chemotherapy before the surgery. Once they cut it out, you're talking about a bag for at least a temporary period of time, if you get what I'm saying about wearing a bag. And depending on where the tumor is, you may be talking about a bag for the rest of your life. But I'm not true. When you come out of surgery, if your oncologist is really aggressive, he or she is going to put you on what they call prophylactic chemotherapy for at least 6 months. I'm still not true. You have to go see your oncologist every 6 months, and once a year they fill you up with that red dye and put you in this machine after you drink all this stuff before they put the red dye in you, because then they have to find out really what they have to take a whole look at things, and only the red dye does that. That goes on for 5 years. Now, I didn't tell you what the cost of all that is. I'll let you add up the cost of each one of those things. As opposed to a precancerous polyp, you don't have a cancerous tumor. Now, I'm just going to say this right here now. There are legislators, in my opinion, walking around right now with precancerous polyps in their colon. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And there's only one way they can truly know the nature of the colon, which is, by the way, I believe, said Aloy Monis Hansen, the oncologist, the colorectal surgeons talked to me, have told me, it is the most sensitive all organ in the body in terms of describing and reflecting your moods and your emotions. It's colon. It's not the brain, it's not the heart, it's not the sweat glands, it's the colon. It's an extraordinary part of the body. So, you know, I understand it's a mandate, but I will tell you, when you add up the cost, and I didn't make up this stuff, of all these things that are done to the human body, by the way, you better throw a psychiatrist or psychologist in there, because often a person is so traumatized, they're going to go over the edge. When you add up all those costs, you tell me which cost is better to have up front. You pay for these tests. Sorry, it is a mandate, and I employ where the politics of this building is not going to get through. Or, because I'll tell you something, if you look at every one of those other surgeries and every one of those treatments, they're covered. To a large extent, they are covered. They are covered. And you're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on a single individual if they have colon cancer. So I realize it is a mandate, no question about it. We're trying to get health care cost containment. To me, this is containment. In terms of, I think I have a right, as much as anybody else, to argue, well, no, you're driving up the cost because you're making the insurance industry pay for this. And I have as much right to say, well, you're right, but what about that when you, if you don't get it early enough, what about those costs? So I just thank you very much for even considering the bill. I think it's a worthwhile piece of legislation. I know we're struggling over mandates, but I tell you, I didn't even get into the pain and suffering or the effect on the human being or the effect on the family or colon cancer and these kinds of things. Because don't forget, each test result, the little room, the mates there, up on the screen, and the tears and the trauma and the emotion. It is unimaginable. Because it isn't over that quick. It isn't over. So I thank you very, very much. And that's the best I can do in this bill. I think it's a good bill. I think it's an important bill. I think it would help. But that's my opinion. I respect whatever you want to do individually or collectively on this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Senator Stark.
Yes. I thank Mr. President that your testimony is compelling. But I would like to add that viewing the inside of your colon in the process is a very fascinating journey. I've been there, done that, and I think everyone should have the experience after they reach age 50 at least.
Well, Jim always said, Senator Charles Starr, I've had 5 colonoscopies and 1 sigmoid. I've only seen myself 1 time because I'm a dangerous patient. I mean, I'm dangerous. But you're right. I remember the one time, it's remarkable. And I'm not trying to get obscene or crazy. We're not trying to be revolting here. We're trying to be very totally honest about it. It is a remarkable thing. And it is remarkable today. I'm trying to talk to a certain legislator and doing this, and she's terrified. It is remarkable today the test can be done with no pain. It's painless, et cetera. It is painless. The very minimum is uncomfortable. That is not fun.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, Senator Cruz, the last part of your testimony I find very compelling. When I turned 50, my doctor told me I needed a colonoscopy, and when I said fine and went home, and my mother explained it to me, and I said, I'll wait till I'm 54. So,
and you're almost there.
I'm almost there. So there's some comfort for me in that. So.
Okay. Other questions? Comments?
Thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
John Powell, are you in the room? Pam Lally? No? Oh, Pam.
True story.
Hello.
Hi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Lally, and I'm representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We are not here in opposition to the bill today. We now we're going to need a cardiologist,
will you
right?
Write that down, please?
As mentioned earlier by Ms. Dresser, this bill does reflect the American Cancer Society recommendations, and Regents is currently following those recommendations. So the bill actually reflects our standard business practice, which is why we are neutral on the bill. We would, however, request a couple of small refinements to the language of the bill, just for clarification. And I can either run through those with you, or I can provide Mr. Bacobian with a colored copy or outline of the recommendations we have.
Give a conceptual idea of what you're doing, and then you can give Mr. Bacobian the details.
Some of the cleanup language is just adding some ors in some of the sections to clarify that the individual would have the option of one of three choices, not two or more. But I'll start with subsection 2, paragraph 2-1A, capital A, adding the word or at the end of the paragraph to clarify, again, that the coverage would be for one of three procedures listed, not two or more.
Okay.
Paragraph 1B, under that same section, striking the younger than 50 years of age, we believe that all members of high risk in the high-risk category should be treated the same regardless of age. So we would recommend striking that language. 2D, we would strike as unnecessary. Health insurance carriers do not require or apply genetic information for the determination of any individual's category of risk. We believe that this information is and should remain between the member and his or her physician. And so we believe that the individual of high risk would be captured under amended paragraph 2D.
Okay.
Under what we would then be numbered is currently D, but would, excuse me, E would become E. We would recommend adding the language as identified by the individual's treating physician and striking paragraph 3. And again, that clarifies that the level of risk is determined by the member's healthcare physician and not by the individual's insurer or the individual themselves. We would also recommend striking subsection 2, paragraph 3, which would make this act not subject to the 6-year sunset provision of law. And the reason we would make this recommendation is that methodologies, modes of treatment, change drastically over time. And if we're going to mandate specific coverage of specific treatment modalities, we would recommend that this be reviewed on a periodic basis to ensure that carriers not only are covering the most efficacious and cost-effective treatment, but that we're not being asked to cover those treatments that have been deemed non-effective. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz, you had also, maybe you mentioned it, I didn't see it, in the markup that you handed us, section 2,
oh, yes,
the sub C, where you crossed out the 2-10 years, so you're saying every 5 years.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, thank you for bringing that to my attention. That was an oversight. The recommendation is just, again, for administrative ease, to simply ask that it be done every 5 years. To try to track every 5 to 10 years just complicates the administration of the benefit.
So this is a mandate by the insurance company, right?
This would not be a mandate by the insurance company.
Oh, okay, I do.
We do not intend to usurp your authority, Mr. Chair.
One more question.
Yes.
So basically, with the amendments, obviously, minus the reference to 43.700, which I agree that should be struck. With the amendments, you're pretty much making this bill mirror current practice.
Yes, this would mirror Regents of Standard practice today.
Okay. I always knew I have a great insurance company. I always knew that.
Thank you.
Good. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Other comments? Okay, thank you very much. John, did you have anything? Okay, good. Okay, with that, we will close.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we should surprise the Senate President if we address these changes. Yeah. And we might have something that would please him very much.
Yeah, but don't tell him in the meantime.
Okay.
We will close the public hearing on 374 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 417. Okay, we're going to stand at ease for just a moment. No,